What first drew me to Lena Meyer-Bergner was the profound intertwining of graphics and textiles in her work. They are completely inseparable. But what I discovered is that she shifted the very definition of what it means to be an artist. Her primary interest wasn't just in making things, it was in designing the process of making itself. The organization of art production became her core theme. This wasn't just an aesthetic strategy for her. Instead, she used it to directly address a core crisis of her time. My name is Sandra Neugärtner, and I'm an art historian specializing in the dynamic relationship between art and society.
For me, it was important to make visible the work of a person who had been so insistent on generating social justice and who had finally been erased from history, you can say, made invisible because she belonged to a political ideology. I am Viridiana Zavala. I am a Mexican art historian.
My name is Anja Guttenberger, and this is my podcast, Bauhaus Faces. Welcome back to a new episode of Bauhaus Faces. It's finally here, a whole new episode about the textile designer Lena Meyer-Bergner that I've promised you for so long. It took some time to bring it all together, though. My two interview partners for today's podcast episode of Bauhaus Faces are the art historians Sandra Neugärtner and Viridiana Zavala. During the past years, Sandra headed the DFG-funded project Lena Meyer-Bergner's socially transformative concept of modernity in the global social transitions of the first half of the 20th century. The project highlights that Lena Meyer-Bergner was an extraordinarily important figure in the international transmission of techniques of knowledge, pedagogy, and material transformation of everyday life. Her life goal was to work for social progress, no matter in which country she was living in. Lena Meyer-Bergner is the center of Sandra Neugärtner's habilitation project, which she had just submitted in May when we met for our conversation. Viridiana Zavala wrote her PhD thesis about Lena Meyer-Bergner, focusing on her graphic work for the Taller de Grafica Popular and the CAPSE during her exile in Mexico from 1939 to 49. I will link all online available articles and projects of Sandra Neugärtner and Viridiana Zavala for you in the show notes. This time, for the first time, I will publish a bonus episode in Spanish, so look out for that one too. Before we start with this brand new episode, I would like to share some news with you. There is now a newsletter available that informs you about new Bauhaus Faces episodes. You can subscribe via the podcast website bauhausfaces.com. The subscription opens as a pop-up window, so maybe you have to wait for a second or two. No worries, if you decide to unsubscribe, at the end of each newsletter there is an unsubscribe option. I'm looking forward to every new subscriber. Let's now dive into a new episode of Bauhaus Faces and shine a light on Lena Meyer-Bergner.
Lena Meyer-Bergner was born Helena Bergner in Coburg on November 25, 1906. Coburg is a small town in Upper Franconia, and her family background is absolutely key to understanding her work. Her family was deeply embedded in the region's textile industry, but in a very specific way. They operated within what is known in German as a Verlagssystem, or a putting-out system. This has nothing to do with book publishing. Instead, it's a decentralized production model where a central entrepreneur distributes raw materials to artisans working from their own homes and then collects the finished products for the wider market. This system defined both the local textile industry of her parents and the internationally renowned toy industry of her grandmother in the nearby town of Sonneberg. And this wasn't just an abstract concept for her, it was her childhood reality. For example, alongside her formal education at the Alexandrinengymnasium, she was already part of this system, crafting small boxes in her free time. She would even accompany her grandmother on visits to the home workers, people sewing doll clothes or making doll heads in their own living rooms. So, through these experiences, she gained this incredibly profound first-hand insight. She didn't just see the craft, she saw the entire system behind it. From the pre-industrial labor of the home workers to the modern administrative logic of the central entrepreneur. This early intimate exposure to the systems of making and labor is what truly shaped her entire artistic and pedagogical approach. After finishing her initial schooling, she first went to a Landschulheim, a kind of rural boarding school near Coburg, but as a helper, not as a student. It seems she was supporting the training there, but soon after, she decided she wanted professional training for herself, specifically in textiles and weaving. And this is a really crucial point, especially in the context of the Bauhaus. There's this persistent narrative that female students were pushed into the weaving workshop against their will. You know, the famous example is Annie Albers, who initially didn't want to go there at all. But for Lena Bergner, this was completely different. By her own account, it was her genuine passion, her own desire and will that drove her to textiles. She had this incredible technical enthusiasm for the different looms and weaving techniques. This really set her apart from many of her fellow students. She was known for being incredibly committed. Her class notes were famously meticulous and detailed, and she just showed this immense dedication to mastering the craft. This made her exceptionally qualified, which was quickly recognized. And what's remarkable is how young she was when she started at the Bauhaus. Barely 20 years old when she began her studies in the winter semester of 1926, right in the newly opened Bauhaus building in Dessau. This high level of qualification meant she was singled out to receive special training, what we might call an internship today, in dyeing technology. This was a huge deal because dyeing was at the cutting edge. It brought together modern technology and the chemical industry, and it was crucial for creating more sustainable and higher quality textiles. So she was sent away for 6 months to a dyeing school in Sorau, Silesia, to learn these modern techniques. When she returned to the Bauhaus with this advanced knowledge, she was immediately put in charge of the dye works, where she could apply everything she had learned.
It was from this course that she began to work from sketching, which learned very early on to textile techniques, but also how to give colors from the dyes that strengthen all these ideas of communication that she had. For me, something very important between the dyeing school and the Bauhaus is her approach to Polki. For her, the most important classes in her life, and if there is something that doesn't change in her biography, it is the importance of the workshops she took with Polki, above all because it gave her a different perception of the pictorial design in textiles. For her, it was relevant to understand that the use of colors above all has a real impact on the human being. And it is something that, for example, in my material culture studies classes, I always talk about with the students that is being textiles. Today, I faithfully believe that all the objects that surround us in some way have a life of their own that generates certain characteristics of the space. And it is something that Lena understood perfectly in Polki's course. She understood that, for example, the tie of the density of the threads in the fabrics could generate temperature dynamics in the space, very important for the moment and above all for the geography of the Soviet Union later. The importance of the warmth that textile can provide in the home or even who psychologically and physiologically colors have an impact on the human being. I could even say on an emotional level, and this is something that Lena was able to understand from her course with Polki. Had she not taken that course, perhaps her textile production could have been very, very different from what we know today in some ways.
In 1930, she became the head of the Königsberg hand weaving mill. Now, this wasn't a factory, it was a company that coordinated a network of home-based weavers. Her role there was multifaceted. On one hand, she was the logistical manager of that same Verlagssystem, or putting-out system, from her family's tradition. But crucially, she was also the creative director. Her key challenge was to design the entire product line, which meant reinterpreting traditional folkloristic motifs for a modern market. So she wasn't just managing the process, delivering raw materials to the individual weavers and collecting finished products. She was shaping the very aesthetic of the production. And it's in this context that she developed a really sharp critical perspective. On the one hand, she saw how the system empowered women, At a time when many women were being pushed out of the workforce as men returned from World War I, home-based weaving offered them economic autonomy and a vital extra income. But on the other hand, she was highly critical of the kind of work being produced. This return to folkloric motifs and traditional crafts was politically charged. She saw that it was dangerously close to the nationalist and völkisch ideologies that were on the rise even before the Nazis seized power. She recognized that in peripheral regions like East Prussia, the strategic promotion of traditional crafts was being used to reinforce a nationalist German identity, a kind of reflection on one's own roots. Lena Bergner was incredibly critical of this. She saw the political instrumentalization of art and craft for propaganda and identity building. She had this remarkably high level of awareness and reflection on these complex issues, which becomes even more significant when you consider that her next stop was Moscow.
In 1931, she resigned from her job as artistic technical director of the Prussian hand weaving mill and traveled to Moscow, where she joined this brigade called the Red Bauhaus Brigade, led by Hannes Meyer. And it was precisely through the coexistence in this communal house or commune where the members lived. And Hannes wrote a letter in which he explained to his former partner, Lotte Wesse, the situation of how they began seeing each other in a different way, because for him, Lena was a comrade, and the word comrade for those of us who are dedicated to the period of the Second World War, it has quite big connotations. There is an aspect of respect toward each other and equality as a colleague. In this letter, he mentions that, well, he is living with her and that he has great admiration for her work and decided to start a relationship with her, a personal relationship, but based on this ideological and professional admiration, which seems to me to be a great revelation, because often these relationships between former Bauhaus teachers and students are romanticized, but it seems to me that we are dealing here with two people who really like their ideology, even with fate, which is what brought them together in such a way. And during her stay in Moscow, much is known about the work that Hannes did, but between 1931 and 1936, she began to work in this factory, Hakalt, decorative can. And something that seems to me spectacular for that time is that she managed to have more than 650 employees in her chairs, which for a woman in 1931 is not a small thing.
The number of employees varies in the different sources. Sandra Neugärtner told me in our interview that Lena Meyer-Bergner herself once said that she had around 600 employees in that factory. In some places, she even mentions only 550, whereas Hannes Meyer wrote in his letters that there were 650 employees. Let's turn now to Sandra and listen to what she has to say about Lena Meyer-Bergner's stay in the Soviet Union.
Getting to the Soviet Union presented its own hurdles, and one of the biggest was the language. She was determined to master it, and within about 6 months she had landed a job as one of only two textile designers in a major factory for furniture fabrics. For a long time, she was the only expert on site. Crucially, her specific expertise was in the Jacquard technique. This was a technology that was viewed with great suspicion at the Bauhaus. They saw it as too industrial, too complex, but Lena Bergner had embraced it. She was one of the few who truly understood it, and it was in Moscow that she could finally put this knowledge into practice. She found herself in a teaching role, training former agricultural workers to become skilled textile technicians in this newly modernized factory.
And it was precisely in the factory, which had an annual production of 3,500,000 meters of fabric for furniture, curtains, and so on, that she had the opportunity to produce at least as far as we have records, 40 drawings for propaganda textiles, because what was done in the factory was political propaganda. So textiles. In the first period, she focused above all on technological teams, on teams that had to do with urban development, as with these ideas that went with the five-year plan of the time. And for the second period, in a way of waiting to reflect national stability, they turn more towards beauty, towards folklore, as if to imply that we have already passed this step of establishing a state of well-being. Now let's enjoy it by being generous with beauty in all homes using textiles.
This period leads to one of her most impressive creations, a small textile fragment from 1933 called Metro. It's a design for a jacquard loom, and what's so stunning about it is that she uses a representational technique taught not to weavers but to architects and engineers at the Bauhaus, axonometry. This is a truly intellectual feat of design. Axonometry works because it uses a parallel grid, meaning the proportions and relationships between lines and surfaces remain true to scale across the entire design. This is something traditional perspective with its vanishing points and distorted scales simply cannot achieve. And here's the brilliant leap. The grid of axonometry perfectly maps onto the technical grid of weaving, the rapport, the cartridge drawing. She achieved a seamless transfer from an architectural drawing technique to serial textile production, and this was only possible because her education was so unique. She wasn't just trained in weaving, she was trained in representation techniques as part of Hannes Meyer's thoroughly polytechnical vision for the Bauhaus. Alongside her craft, she studied subjects like business economics. This education empowered her to think beyond the loom, to conceptualize textiles as spatial, grid-based systems. Almost like a carpet city, where the underlying grid structure could be both pictorial and abstract at the same time. Her design for Metro exists in this incredible space, perfectly balancing a realistic depiction of a modernist city with a deep structural abstraction.
The textile Metro seems to me, as an art historian, an exceptional piece for its manufacture and for everything it's transmitted to you, because you really look at and you can feel yourself inside a metro station, although it's a repetitive pattern. Somehow, there is something in that textile that situates you in a space and time, but beyond an object. I do believe that if you make a review, which is what I have been trying to do for a little over the last decade, if our reviewing Lena's work deserves inflection points or these paradigmatic points in her career have to do with this space to that open up her when she worked in the factory. I think it's very important that she's always thinking in terms of social justice, but she's not a person like a many intellectuals of time who is looking at from a distance, who is talking about the work of the workers, of the peasants from a distance, but she's involved in that work. She's involved in that system. She's living it day by day. I insist it takes its toll on their lives. It is not without cost, because the mayors don't belong to an elite of architecture and design. That's why for me, it's fundamental to understand that perhaps we cannot rescue many objects, but we can rescue this key point.
But of course, she wasn't working in a vacuum. This was the era of the five-year plan, and she was under immense pressure to create pictorial designs that functioned in the spirit of the state. Lena Meyer-Bergner understood this reality. She went along with it, but as she would later reflect with incredible clarity, she was always critically aware of the situation. In a report from the 1970s, looking back on this time with decades of distance, she explained how the state tried to use textiles as a propaganda medium. On the one hand, she had pragmatically fulfilled her duties, designing patterns with tractors and tanks for the Red Army. It was from this later perspective that she described this work as the low point of her creative achievements, making it clear that it had never been in her core spirit to simply contribute to a superficial beautification of life. On the other hand, and this is where her brilliance truly shines, she found ways to resist. Her design, Metro, is a perfect example of this subtle resistance. For her, it was an abstract pattern and a highly intellectual work. And yet it was approved by the committees. Why? Because they didn't understand its visual language. Socialist realism would have demanded heroic perspective. She chose axonometry, the objective grid-based language of modernism. She depicted a modernist city in axonometry, not in a socialist perspective one. And it worked precisely because the committee saw a city and thought it was good, completely missing the fact that its modernist form language subverted the very ideology it was supposed to serve. It slipped right past them. Ultimately, her political position was complex. Her motivation for going to the USSR was always to help build a new, more social world, not to become an instrument of propaganda. She remained a committed anti-fascist, and for her, the Soviet Union stood as the only powerful bulwark against the forces she opposed. Not just fascism, but the capitalist system she was so critical of. But this choice came with a heavy and deeply ironic price. She had to navigate the escalating reality of Stalin's Soviet Union. This adherence to the underlying ideal of the collective is something you see even later in her life in Mexico. She saw the flaws in the system. She resisted its crude instrumentalization, but she never abandoned her fundamental belief in the socialist project itself. I wouldn't say she just turned a blind eye to Hannes Meyer's politics. In fact, I'd argue she was right there with him, at least initially. You see it in her work from that time, the textile designs featuring tanks and other Soviet motifs. She was actively working in the Soviet Union until 1935. Things started to unravel for them around then. After a critical lecture by a figure named Achitovich, they both fell out of favor. The political purges were beginning, and it quickly became clear that the Soviet Union was no longer a safe place for them. When Meyer was shut out from his official posts, it was a clear signal. For Lena, it was simple. If he had to leave the country, she was going with him. As one historian puts it, Meyer, as a Soviet-trained Western European, wanted to join the battlefront of the West. I think that captures it perfectly. And Lena felt that same pull. She knew it was time for a new chapter. Their first plan was Spain. She actually went ahead to Mallorca first, heavily pregnant at the time, but then history intervened in the form of Franco's fascist uprising. Hannes Meyer was on a lecture tour and was supposed to join her, but with the political situation exploding, it just wasn't possible for him to enter Spain. So by the summer of 1936, she had to leave as well. By July of 36, she'd made it to Geneva. And just a month later, in August, their first child, Liselotte, was born. They officially married the next year in 1937, and from that point on, she started using the double name Meyer Bergner. And they found this incredible place to live there, the Immeuble Clarté in Geneva. It's this stunning apartment building designed by Le Corbusier and Pierre Jeanneret. It had only been finished a few years earlier, and they moved into this modern flat with a lovely balcony. There are many wonderful photos of their daughter, Lilo, on that balcony. Now, the building had these small garages for each apartment on the ground floor. Lena turned one of them into her own small workshop. She started producing knotted carpets right there at home. It was a fairly uncommon medium for Switzerland, which was known for other established textile arts, like weaving and more specifically tapestry. This workshop, however, became their lifeline. With her political background, all official doors were closed to her. She couldn't get a teaching position like, say, Sophie Teuber-Arp, even though she was perfectly qualified. No official textile institute would hire her. So out of necessity, she was forced to completely reorient her thinking within this new bourgeois, capitalist world. She had to carve out a new role for herself, and that meant taking on tasks she'd never had to deal with before, like marketing and sales. Suddenly, she was a one-woman operation, not just designing and producing, but also responsible for getting her work out there. This new reality shaped everything she did, from designing her own company letterhead to publishing articles about her work. It was all about creating an external visibility, an almost commercial presence that was entirely new for her.
Lena starts again with her manual textile work. She starts to develop manual techniques. She creates a lot of hand weavings, mostly inspired by nature. They are really beautiful letters of her, especially written by Hannes, who in some way wrote for both of them, but where they express the experience of contemplation of nature that Lena had. She could go to the Alps and climb the mountains, and there is a kind of closeness to nature, but also a kind of admiration for all this creation that escapes from her hands that somehow becomes sublime and so serene. And she becomes very contemplative, very thoughtful, and I insist that she develops in hand-weaving textiles. But I also feel that one of the great strengths in her theoretical ideas is to be able to understand very well the natural aspects, like this natural biological development of the man in the world, and to be able to make a good match with the technologies of the time. They arrive in the port of Veracruz. Hannes enters with the profile of a professor, architect, and urban planner, and Lena enters as a professor at the time, because precisely during this government of Lázaro Cárdenas exiles, but also people who were in danger of political persecution were encouraged to come to Mexico. And it seems to me the mayors arrive in a context in which in Mexico there is an enrichment of the networks of artists and intellectuals due to all the migration that is happening. And they are also very well received. And there is a group of architects and artists that help themselves quietly, and they move them into the flat they were in for 10 years, which was in Villalongin 48 in Mexico City. What seems to me very remarkable is that, unlike other colleagues they have, although it's usually the man who is offered a job in the country they are going to, and the woman and the family just simply come with them. In this case, Hannes was very concerned, and there are many letters about this where he put Lena's work forward. He introduced her as a person who can share her textile knowledge, and that is why she enters with this profile of a teacher.
Let's start with a single document, an immigration card issued by the Mexican consulate in Paris in November 1938. The name on the card is Helene Bergner de Meyer. She is 33 years old, listed as married, and her profession is artista pintora, an art painter. This card gave her permission for a one-year renewable stay in Mexico. What's remarkable is the timeline. She applied for this card incredibly early. Although she was registered as a foreigner in Mexico in July of 1939, her official registration didn't happen until much later in March of 1942. The reason for this move was a major professional prospect. She had been promised a leading role in setting up a new textile institute at the prestigious Instituto Politécnico Nacional, or IPN. This wasn't just a vague hope. Letters from the time show that she was counting on this opportunity as her new starting point in exile. She wasn't alone, of course. Her husband, Hannes Meyer, was already employed at the IPN, heading the newly founded Institute for Urban Development and Planning, which he led from 1939 to 1941. So, with this future role in mind, Meyer Bergner began working on a major project, a book called Knüpfen und Weben, ein Berufsbild, which translates to Knotting and Weaving, a Professional Profile. Now, this was a completely different project from, say, Annie Elber's famous book on weaving. As Ty Smith described it, Elber's writing was more of a philosophical treatise. Lena's manuscript, on the other hand, was a deeply practical hands-on manual. It gets right down to the nitty-gritty. How do you create a design template? What exactly is a repeat? What are the different weaving and loom techniques? How does a Dobby loom work compared to a Jacquard machine? She also explored materials and dyeing methods, but crucially, she didn't stop at the technical. She constantly asked about the social implications. What are these techniques for? And what happens when they are put into practice in a community? To explain all of this, the book was filled with remarkable sketches, drawings that are simultaneously technical, educational, and artistic. She used the modern technique of axonometry to create incredibly clear drawings that illustrate the concepts in the text. You can literally follow along, section by section, if she's explaining the thread feed for the warp, there's a clear image showing you exactly how it works right next to the text. So who was this incredibly detailed manual for? It seems to have had a dual purpose. On one hand, it was almost certainly intended for the future textile institute at the IPN. But on the other hand, it was also designed for the community-based textile centers she was planning for the indigenous Otomi people. The manual could serve as a guide for local instructors and weavers, transferring technical knowledge by reviving techniques that were perhaps no longer widely known, or by introducing methods that were not yet known at all. The strong connection between graphics and textiles in her work points to something much bigger. It taps into the modernist idea of reorganizing art production and redefining how art is made and its place in society. This wasn't just a conservative transfer of technical skills. By interpreting these techniques, she elevated the entire process. The manual itself becomes more than just a guide. It becomes a cultural artifact, a statement on the societal value of craft. And this gets to the heart of what's so exciting about her work. She was pioneering a new field that perfectly matched her understanding of art. For her, art wasn't something precious to be hung on a wall to be admired by the bourgeoisie. Instead, art had a pragmatic, application-based purpose. It was about designing the material world we surround ourselves with, and it was a tool for organizing work, production, and communication. And this very idea brings us back to the comparison with Annie Albers, because it highlights what I see as the fundamental difference in their approaches, especially regarding other cultures. Albers' strategy, as influential as it was largely one of appropriation, of taking inspiration from pre-Columbian Latin American cultures and transferring it into a Western modernist context. Lena's approach was radically different. Hers was one of on-site engagement, of working within communities in Mexico, aiming to empower them directly. This distinction is a central argument of my work, and it's a topic I explore in much greater detail in my book on Lena Meyer-Bergner's approach and an academic article I'm currently preparing for publication.
By 1940, they began to have conversation with the DNA, which is the Department of Indigenous Affairs in Mexico. And it is precisely because of this that Lena was offered this project to form a school in a rural area that had to do with textiles, but which is also part of a more general program in the country. At that time, there were quite a few changes in education policies in Mexico, especially literacy programs, but also how we were going to bring technological advance to all areas of the country, not only in the cities, which at the time was only Mexico City, really. Only a few or none of the other states had cities as such, because urbanization was something that was just happening at the time, as there was a change of life of the rural populations that was migrating to the cities. So how do we bring this urbanization to this other place through alphabetization programs, but also with technical schools? So it was at the moment that Lena was invited. The director of this department began to make different visits, which was also very important. And the artist from LEAR, in Spanish, Liga de Escritores y Artistas Revolucionarios, and the Taller de Gráfica Popular, who come from the LEAR, they are part of this. There are many images and there are letters in the collections where they talk about these visits they made to the rural areas, above all to the nearby areas in the state of Mexico, which are the areas bordering Mexico City. And Lena joins this campaign to bring this type of teaching. She and Hannes did a lot of studies, which can be found in my doctoral thesis and which we could spend 8 hours or more talking about here. It is something that is striking because we know a lot of about the architectural part, about the projects, the competitions. Raquel Franklin's thesis was the starting point to be able to talk about this. I mean, Patricia Rivadeneira had also talked about the Hannes case before Raquel, but it was really Raquel who started to show us the architectural part in its maximum splendor. Lennart wrote a beautiful manual in Spanish and German, which could have been passed on to the Ottoman indigenous people, and it makes perfect sense. If you are going to have a technical school in this region, and she says in that manual, if you want to weave a textile, you need so much yarn that it's going to cost you so much in the Mexican context, and that you can combine it with this thread and this one. And I think that this work could have been quite successful if the workshop could have been carried out. There are also the plans that Hannes helped her draw up for the textile workshop they were going to build. She goes back and for all the time from Mexico City to this space with her colleagues with the Department of Indigenous Affairs. However, what is her reality, and that is why I think it's important to say that she had worked in Moscow as the head of the department of 650 people, including male and female workers, and what happened now in Mexico when she wanted to run a small technical teaching workshop in the Mezquital Valley, it became impossible. That is why, in other words, people talk about this is a moment of failure, but for me it was a moment of success. If you look at it from the point of view of cultural management and education, all the time they're reviewing information, then you realize that for 10 years they didn't stop. I mean, they really didn't stop for even 1 second in their production. It's incredible. If you look at it from the other side, it's successful. There are beautiful photos, for example, with Leopoldo Mendes, with all the members of the Taller de Gráfica Popular, where they go in a van, and you can see the van parked in the middle of these beautiful valleys of the state of Mexico. And they are constantly doing observation work. That is, there are letters where they analyze how the work of textile, especially in the Ottoman area, has to do with a family context of the people who live there. It is precisely this woman, as Hannes says, that is, it's impressive how they don't get tired. They are making yarn all the time with these maguey tips, spinning to be able to generate these threads that are later passed on to the homes where the women are with the children in core yarns, sitting next to a tree, making backstrap looms. They really did a whole process of ethnological and anthropological analysis. They learn a lot of, which for me it's very important to mention, because it is often so that in some way, and not only in Europe, as we discussed in the case of Clara Porcet too, that it is often so that it is precisely these profiles that come from outside who have a kind of teaching role for the people who were in Mexico. But I really think that Lena, especially Lena, speaking more from the role of textile, learned a lot. So it was a period like the one in Switzerland of a lot of contemplation, being very much in harmony with nature. There are precious engravings by Lena that it was able to analyze in my doctoral thesis, some of which speak of this moment of knowing even the landscape where the textile workshop is being developed. Because I do believe that the environment where developed speaks volumes about themselves. In 1942, she and Hannes decided to join the Taller de Gráfica Popular in a more official way, if you like. It was there together with Leopoldo Mendes that they created the hallmark of Mexican printmaking, La Estampa Mexicana, was precisely this publishing of house of the TGP that sought to somehow generate resources to continue with political propaganda from the graphic arts. In that same period, between 1942 and 43, Lena was trying to publish her manual. The school project was no longer topical, but she wanted to publish the manual. She didn't succeed, but these drawings, which are now in the Harvard Museums, were the result. It is from the moment on that she, well, in a way, everything she sketched by hand, and the handmade ones are beautiful. She began a research to trying to transfer them to the printing press. She didn't know success. She continued Mexican printmaking, which was little or, in fact, almost nothing at all. Adico research Helga Pregnitz mentions in her last book about the Taller de Grafica Popular that Lena's work in a very meticulous way as the one who made the folders for the graphic albums. But the reality is that Lena has an important role in that she is dedicated to researching the profiles, but also together with Hannes, she takes care of the administrative part. What is clear to me is the part of the fundamental public relations for this couple was Lena Meyer-Werner. Lena had many acquaintances in the world, and there are even correspondence in which one realizes that she was the one who provided the context to offer those Mexican graphic folders in the world and to be able to have the resources to be able to continue turning the screw in this production of political propaganda. During that period, she was also very active in politics, generating more or less 18 traveling exhibitions that had to do above all with the Society of Friends of the USSR, which was set up to support the Soviet Union during the Second World War. It is very interesting because they are exhibitions in a kind of montage format that gets very close to the public eyes. There is a precious one that it set up precisely during the book fair era in Mexico City, and which is also very close to a very important monument for us, which is the Monument to the Revolution. And it is important because it has been emblematic for the city for many decades. It is also a place that is constantly visited by public on foot. And it's interesting to see the image because in this exhibition, she does things that are very playful. Suddenly, there is a Wheel of Fortune with image and letters from Soviet soldiers, but it is also has different murals on the walls expressing Soviet culture, inviting the visitors of this space to write to Soviet soldiers. They become just like those very playful exhibitions of propaganda that in some way are inviting people to become politicized, perhaps unconsciously, because perhaps the child who was walking through, they didn't expect that point to receive a dose of political propaganda, and in a roundabout way, they end up doing it. She mentioned it in her letters too. She and Hannes are also constantly visit the embassy of the Soviet Union because of these issues. Together with the Taller de Grafica Popular, they execute totally this line of propaganda and really bring the political news of the moment to the masses. There is a lot of talk, for example, that in Mexico, the murals or the muralists like Diego Rivera or José Clemente Orozco made public art with murals. But for me, the most public art at the time, they are that really reach the masses. They are that was not enclosed in a building, was the graphics. These graphics that suddenly appear as leaflets and could be stuck on a corner in the historic center. There are many photos of these graphics that are stuck up in the street in a totally accessible way. So I think that's precisely why Lena and Hannes were so close to Leopoldo Méndez's group. It was this way of getting all the information across through the flyers, through the posters, and Lena and Hannes also became the key to being able to begin to disseminate this type of Mexican art in the world. And around 1945, continuing this line of propaganda, teaching exhibitions, Hannes began to work on the Federal School Construction Program Management Committee, El CAPSE for its acronym in Spanish, Documentary Archive of 1943, and these projects began. It wasn't until 1944 that the whole subject properly began. While taking care of this archive, it occurred to Jaime Torres Bodet and other architects that it would be good to have an exhibition, and they entrusted it to Hannes. The interesting thing here is that they commissioned him to produce it in only a month. An exhibition for the Palacio de Bellas Artes, which is perhaps the most important culture venue in Mexico. It seems to me what this was quite an odyssey in that sense. Just when they asked him to do it in a month, he started to get a group together. Obviously, his colleagues from the Taller de Gráfica Popular and Lena, to be able to create and produce this exhibition in collaboration with the architects. And they developed an exhibition that talks about the production of the capsule between 1943 and 45. They wanted to give a bit of an idea of what has been done, but also of what will be done in the future. So they make different graphics, but they also do a lot of statistics, which is where Lena can put in practice what she had learned during her class with Joseph Smith at the Bauhaus. And they generate different statistics because what CAPSE does is to extract these statistics and pass them on to a graphic communication or visual communication environment. And this is tremendously enormous map, which you can see on the photos of the Palacio de Bellas Artes in comparison with to the people. The height of the people is huge, and it's just helped a little to give an account of the number of schools that had been built during 3 years and that were in planning to build in Mexico City and in different states. It is a map of Mexican Republic with all these representative symbols of statistics that they make. And it is also very interesting that Lena not only leaves it a map of the exhibition, but later they reorganize it into an exhibition memory where state by state, the current state of each of the programs at the state level is reviewed. And Lena does all these statistics.
One of the most fascinating projects Lena Meyer-Bergner was involved in was the National School Building Program in Mexico. Hannes Meyer was the director of communication for this program, responsible for its public image. He managed its photo archive, conceptualized exhibitions, and designed the brochures. And Lena was deeply involved in this work alongside him. What stood out to me when I researched this topic was the unique symbolic language she used in her work for it. I identified this language as isotype. ISOTYPE stands for International System of Typographic Picture Education. It grew out of the Vienna Method of Pictorial Statistics, developed in the mid-1920s by a brilliant team around the philosopher and social scientist Otto Neurath. This group included figures like Maria Reidemeister and the artist Gerd Arns, all working at Vienna's Social and Economic Museum. The whole idea was to create a visual language that could communicate complex social and political information without relying on text. Its visual style is very distinct, with clear roots in the work of the Cologne progressives. Artists like Franz Seiwert and Heinrich Hörle and also Gerd Arns belonged to them. They had developed this stark, stencil-like aesthetic to depict information powerfully and directly. And it was this exact style that caught Otto Neurath's eye at an exhibition in 1926. He saw its immense potential for his mission of public education, or what the Germans call Aufklärung, enlightenment. So a big question is, where did Meyer-Bergner actually learn about isotype? The exact moment is hard to pin down, but we have several strong possibilities. It might have been at the Bauhaus itself, perhaps during a guest lecture by Otto Neurath, or maybe in the advertising workshop or Joost Schmidt's class, since we know Schmidt used isotype for official design work for the city of Dessau. Another very likely source is her time in Moscow. This is where Neurath had founded a sister institute called ISOSTAT with the express purpose of implementing the Vienna method in the Soviet Union. It's highly probable that the method was a hot topic of discussion among Hannes Meyer and the Rote Bauhaus Brigade. Plus, we know for a fact that Lena had access to ISOSTAT publications right in her own home, thanks to her husband, Hannes Meyer. When you look at the formal style, Meyer-Bergner's figures aren't exact copies of the classic stencil-like isotype figures influenced by the Cologne progressives. Hers are different. They're more simplified, almost like stick figures, which actually brings them closer in style to the work of Joost Schmidt. Of course, Neurath's ambition was global. He saw isotype as a tool for empowerment and established institutes all over the world to promote this universal visual language. Interestingly, one of those institutes was founded right there in Mexico around the same time she was there. It seems to be a case of parallel developments, with isotype being introduced in Mexico but in a slightly different, more two-dimensional style.
There is incredible amount of illustration by the people of the Taller de Gráfica Popular, and this is how Hannes somehow involves all his colleagues, including Lena, makes them part of this exhibition that, I think, was very successful because we are talking about the Palace of Fine Arts here. Not only did they occupy the ground floor of the museum, but Hannes also made some structure in the scale one by one that were moved to the explain part of the public part of the building. So the number of people who received information created visually by Lena was huge. After this exhibition, they continued their work as managers, but in exhibition in Russia, Switzerland, and the USA. But the economic implications of being active in politics were of great importance. At one point, when the war is over, they decided around 1948, 49, to somehow start knocking on doors again in Europe. It was not very successful. In fact, there are already some accounts of how maybe Hannes could get a role in a university with many others who came back from America to Europe, but this never happened. Hannes died a few years after returning to Europe, but they still live with this impetus to continue collaborating with the Taller de Gráfica Popular. Lena still has contact until the last day of her life with her colleagues with the Taller de Gráfica Popular. It was something that marked them very much. When Hannes died, all members of the Taller de Gráfica Popular were the first people to be there for her through the letters and so on.
Let's turn to the final chapter of their lives. By the end of the 1940s, as they were leaving Mexico, Lena and Hannes were in a very difficult financial position. The cost of the crossing on the Italian passenger ship, the Andrea Gritti, a significant 4,000 Swiss francs, was entirely financed by a group of close friends from Geneva, Arnold Höckel, John Thorkappel, and Hans Berger. From there, they traveled through Italy, reconnecting with old comrades like Mario Montagnana and Vittorio Vidali, before eventually settling in a small village near Lugano in Switzerland called Crocifisso di Savosa. They chose it mainly because the housing there was affordable, but they saw it as just a temporary stop. Their real hope was to return to Geneva, the city that had been their home in the late 1930s after leaving Moscow but before their journey to Mexico. But things didn't get easier. In the early 1950s, Hannes Meyer's health was already failing. He would later be diagnosed with cerebral sclerosis. So Lena tried to keep the family afloat. Just as she had done in Geneva years before, she started weaving carpets again in their home. She also tried designing wallpapers and explored other textile work, desperately trying to solve their financial problems because the carpets just weren't selling like they used to. And the reason for that was simple. Savosa wasn't Geneva. In Geneva, she had a network and a completely different kind of clientele. In Savosa, she had to build there a new network from scratch, what didn't turn out that successful. But her friend Kay Adams, an architect from their time in Mexico, was incredibly supportive. And in my research, I uncovered a key episode showing just how far these efforts went. Adams actually acted as an intermediary to connect Lena with the Germanic Museum at Harvard. What makes this so fascinating is that this episode also involves Annie Albers, potentially setting the stage for a collaboration between these two major figures. But ultimately, like so many of her efforts, it didn't lead to much. The kind of network that is so crucial for an artist to survive in a capitalist economy simply wasn't there for her anymore. So gradually she moved further and further away from textile production and turned to writing, copy editing, and illustration jobs to get by. This doesn't mean she became a famous author. She wrote a few small children's books and designed coloring books. And to give you an idea of the context, these were, for example, Christmas coloring books where a third of the pages were filled with local advertising. She also illustrated fairy tales by the brothers Grimm and Theodor Storm, but her designs were rejected by publishers and were never successful. And yet, There's a puzzling part of her story. She never spoke about what it was, but she once mentioned a 20-year service anniversary in a letter to her son. We simply don't know what kind of work she was doing. In the end, she found a way to make a living, but not in the field she loved. Her greatest wish to gain a foothold in the world of textiles again, sadly, never materialized.
Most of Lena Meyer Bergner's estate has ended up on the auction market and is therefore today scattered throughout the world. Some of it is in the Archiv der Moderne in Weimar. Another part is at the archive of the Bausdesser Foundation. There are several pieces at the Harvard Art Museum in the US and at the National Gallery in Australia. There are pieces in Switzerland, Moscow, and, of course, in Mexico. A complete exhibition of Lena Meyer Bergner's work, Sandra Neugärtner says, is therefore almost impossible. Lena Meyer Bergner and Hannes Meyer spent over 20 years together, and of course, their lives are closely intertwined. In this episode, we really focused on Lena Meyer Bergner's life and work. If you feel that there are any parts missing about Hannes Meyer or his projects, I can really recommend listening to the podcast episodes of Bauhaus Faces about him too. There's part one with Dara Kieser about Meyer's way to the Bauhaus and the changes he made in the education and public relations of the Bauhaus. Part two with Tatjana Efrusi focuses on the 6 years he worked in the Soviet Union. Part three with Raquel Franklin completely centers around Hannes Meyer's political engagement and achievements in Mexico and the time afterward. And there are, of course, the episodes about Annie Albers, Gunter Stölzel and Paul Klee too. All of them were mentioned in this podcast episode. As always, I will link the most important articles, books and websites for this episode in the show notes for you. If you liked this episode or any other episode of Bauhaus Faces, please don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify or YouTube and recommend it to friends, family or colleagues. And don't forget to subscribe to my brand new podcast newsletter on BauhausFaces.com to stay up to date about new episodes of Bauhaus Faces. And now, there's nothing left to say but tune in next time for a new episode of Bauhaus Faces.